across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan
Show! Hello there. We're continuing with our journalism around the winter fuel payments and what the Stormont executive is or is not going to do. Such is the nature of the Nolan Show, of course. We do that. And we also talk about skinny dipping. Mrs. Robinson does quite a lot of it, apparently. She's on the show too. Have a listen. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. As you know, for nearly a week now, we've been going on and on about the winter fuel payments for people in Northern Ireland, for pensioners. And our job is to get you clarity as soon as possible as to what the Stormont executive is going to do. And when are they going to give you a decision? 03030 80 55 55 is our number this morning. Brian Kingston from the DUP is with us today. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. And look, it's a DUP minister, Gordon Lyons, who's in charge of the Department for Communities. And we really appreciate you coming on this morning to provide clarity. I was driving the car, listening to Good Move this morning, and I heard you say this to Sarah Brett, about the British government and what they should do. Brian, let's have a listen.
We do call on the UK government to restore the payment, or at the very least to look at alternatives which will help those vulnerable pensioners who may be not entitled to pensions credit or the other benefits which qualify them for the winter fuel allowance, but to look at other measures which will mitigate the worst impact.
You're calling on the British government to do something, Brian, that Stormont could do, that your minister could do.
Yes, well, as I said earlier in that interview, Stephen, it's important to understand that welfare benefits are paid directly from Westminster, and they don't come through as part of the Northern Ireland Block Grant for Public Services. So when people are claiming benefits, that's like extra money that comes into Northern Ireland. So any time there's a change in the benefit system at Westminster, in virtually every case, Northern Ireland maintains parity with that. For us to have a different benefit system would mean money coming out of our block grant.
Correct.
For public services.
But that would be a choice for Stormont, wouldn't it? We've done it before with bedroom tax, for example, super parity.
I think that's the only example where we have operated a different benefit system. There's been similar calls over things like the benefit cap and the two-child limit and universal credit. But each time you're talking about an impact in tens of millions of pounds,
correct,
typically between 50 and £100 million.
But the point I'm making this morning is that if we listened, Brian, and you did explain parity, to be fair, to Sarah on Good Morning Ulster this morning. But the point I'm making is that if you listened to that interview this morning, you might have thought that, you know, you literally were asking the British government to protect some pensioners here that fell outside the entitlement. Because they might be a few quid over getting pension credit. Stormont could decide to do that. You wouldn't have to give it to all pensioners. You could decide to create a policy which protects some pensioners. And you could revenue raise to do it if you wanted to do it. You're making choices. Stormont's making choices here, right?
Yeah, and that's the reality of being in government and for ministers running departments and for the executive as a whole, and they will have to make a decision on this. And it will be a decision for the executive as a whole. The finance minister has said that.
And finance minister said that?
Well, she has said that this is a decision for the executive as a whole, and we agree with that.
Well, we contacted...
Every minister...
We contacted... Just let me tell you this, Brian, and then I'll shut up, because I want you to have space to talk. But we contacted the Department of Finance and asked when the decision was going to be made for pensioners. And the Department of Finance came back to us and said that this sits under the remit of the Department of Communities. In other words, this is the remit of your minister, Gordon Lyons. Department of Finance didn't tell us it's for the executive as a whole.
Yeah, well, anything to do with legislation relating to benefits, when there's changes made that have to go through the Northern Ireland Assembly, they will go through the Department for Community and the Committee for Communities, which I'm a member of, and we will scrutinise that. But this is an overall financing decision. This could affect the Department for Communities doesn't have a budget which could on its own compensate for any changes in the welfare system made at Westminster by the Department for Work and Pensions.
Why doesn't Gordon Lyons do what the Paul Given, your party colleague in education, has said, which is he's going to overspend anyway, which Mike Nesbitt has said in the Department of Health there are certain cuts he will not make. So why doesn't Gordon Lyons say, I'm not prepared to cut the money for pensioners?
Well, as I say, this payment comes directly from Westminster, so it's not something that the minister here has control over. The funding is delivered from Westminster, and the decision has been made by the new Labour Parliament, new Labour government. Wasn't in their manifesto, as people will be aware. This decision, the election was only last month. But every department, Mike Nesbitt for Health Service, Paul Given for Education, Naomi Long for Policing and Justice, John O'Dowd for Infrastructure, and the other ministers all say they have severe shortfalls in their funding. Gordon Lyons in the Department for Communities has already stated that he is facing a shortfall of around £115 million for resources this year. He set that out when he did announced a quality impact assessment in June.
Look, you're not ducking this, Brian. So again, you're coming on the radio, you're talking us through it. Thank you for doing so. This is what we want from our locally elected politicians. But am I right in pointing out that this is a decision that could be locally made? It's nigh on impossible, given the stretches on the budget in Northern Ireland, to find 70 million to protect the situation as it is. But the Minister for Communities, Gordon Lyons, could decide to protect some more pensioners, come up with ideas as to who, maybe not the richest pensioners, but which cohort of pensioners maybe do deserve more protection. He could do that. He could propose that to Stormont, asking for more money, rather than Labour has decided this. Correct?
Well, that will be a decision for the executive as a whole. And I can't tell you their mind on that or what decision they will reach. I appreciate that people would like early clarity on this. And I would hope that there will be a decision made as soon as possible. But the Communities Minister, Gordon Lyons, does not have a large budget sitting unspent. In fact, he has a shortfall of over £100 million.
But has he any proposals as to who should be protected? If we can't afford all pensioners, does the DUP have a position on which other pensioners should be protected?
Well, as I say, first and foremost, we are calling on the government at Westminster to reverse this cut, or at least to come up with measures that it will fund. It has the large budget. It is where the funding for the Winter Fuel Allowance has come from Treasury at Westminster. And we it is right that we first and foremost ask them to come up with those mitigating measures rather than cutting public services here to compensate for cuts that Westminster government has made.
So the Finance Minister, Kevin Archibald, has said that the executive will have to discuss this issue. We know that Gordon Lyons told us on the 13th of August, over 2 weeks ago now, that he would ask the executive to urgently consider this. Have those conversations happened?
I can't tell you. I'm not involved in the inner workings of the executive. But the DUP will always be on the side of protecting income and support for pensioners, particularly our more vulnerable pensioners. As I mentioned earlier, in 2017, in the Confidence and Supply Agreement with the then Theresa May's government, we made it a condition of that Confidence Supply Agreement that there would be no changes to the triple lock on the state pension increases, and also no change to the universal nature of the winter fuel payment. And that was the case during that government.
Look, we can see where the Finance Minister, Keith Archibald, that's a Sinn Féin minister, has said that the executive would need to discuss this issue. Now, we were told by the Department of Finance it is Minister Lyons' remit. That's a fact. That's what we were told. But are there any proposals from the DUP to the Department of Finance?
Well, as I say, that matter will have to be discussed by the executive. I'm not party to the inner workings of that. And we are putting the pressure first and foremost on government at Westminster. That is where the cuts have been made, and that is where there's no easy solution to this.
But Brian, you must know
there's no extra money. I don't know the inner workings of the discussions on it.
The discussions
will have to happen at the executive. I'm not an executive minister. I can't tell you the inner workings.
But you're an experienced, articulate guy, so you must know that the Prime Minister Keir Starmer stood up in the Rose Garden 2 days ago and doubled down on the decision not to give the winter fuel payment to pensioners in England, Scotland and Wales. He said it was a difficult decision, we didn't want to have to do it, but we've had to do it. So you must know that it is incredibly unlikely that Keir Starmer is going to hand extra money to people in the pensioners in Northern Ireland and not give it to the pensioners where the votes are in England. Like, it's incredibly unlikely, and you know that. So what I'm trying to understand today is, has Stormont any ideas for our pensioners here? And if they don't, why don't they just say it's going to be cut?
Yeah, well, that is a decision which will have to be made at a meeting of the executive. I know that there's no easy solutions to this because, as I say, the winter fuel allowance was extra money coming into Northern Ireland directly from Westminster. And for any time we break parity with the welfare benefit system from Westminster, it means taking money out of our own block grant for public services in Northern Ireland.
Or it means revenue raising.
And there's no easy solutions to that.
Government isn't easy. Would the DUP consider imposing extra charges, I don't know, on some of the wealthiest in Northern Ireland? You could do that through rates, some of the people with big houses. Would the DUP consider revenue raising in order to protect the winter fuel payment for pensioners?
Yeah, but look, I'm not going to be able to tell you what the outcome to the discussions at the executive will be, even if I was in a position to know what any of the mind was, those discussions will have to take place around the executive table.
But Brian, the discussions within the executive require each political party to have a position. What is the DUP's position? Would you rule out revenue raising when you go into that executive meeting saying, here's what we should do?
Yeah, no, as I say, first and foremost, we are calling on Westminster government to restore or to introduce mitigation.
And we've agreed it's not going to happen.
Well, that's not our position. We're not giving up on that. That is where the pressure should be. And otherwise, discussions will have to take place around the executive table. And I'm not going to be able to tell you the mind or the outcome of those discussions.
Have a listen to Derek
and
Kilkee.
I don't know the answer.
Morning, Derek.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
I'm on about pensioners that would be only get the pension. The top rate of the pension is £218. If you've anything over that, you're cut off from getting pension credit. And I would be one of those pensioners because my pension is over the £218.
What do you want to see Stormont do?
Well, the people which would be getting pension credit, they also get DVLA, and they get the pension. And they are still eligible for to get the oil, the water, cold weather payment.
Okay.
I do understand what the government operates. Somebody on the one pension, maybe just one person, I live alone, and what pension I have has to cover my rates.
And do you really need this money, Derek?
I'm asking the question. If you were getting £218 a week, would you be looking for help with oil?
Okay, Derek, thank you. Linda Robinson's with us from AGNI, Chief Executive of AGNI. Good morning to you, Linda.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. This is a devolved decision. Brian Kingston is right that it would cost to protect the current position would cost a lot of money that the Department of Communities does not have. But it's a local decision, Linda. And what this program's trying to do is establish, publicly establish, from all the different political parties, where they stand in this.
And I think that's important, certainly for older people in Northern Ireland and their families. Our concern has been that we have been inundated with calls from worried older people, particularly given that the decision has come out of the blue with a few months into a winter planning cycle, and they haven't had an opportunity to prepare or to look at how they can mitigate these circumstances. It's certainly disappointing that the discussions seem to be stalling somewhat in terms of how we will help and support those people, as you heard with your caller there, particularly those who will not be able to claim a pension credit. They may be a pound over, but the significant rise in heating costs and fuel costs, food costs, will really make an impact on that particular section of older people. And certainly the callers that we have had to our helpline has been stating the urgency around what our local decision makers will say, recognising that, as you said earlier, government's not easy, but that's the decisions you have to make in government, is to support your local people.
Like, do you know, you're the chief exec of HNI, do you know where Sinn Féin, the DUP Alliance, Ulster Unionist Party, SDLP stand on this? What their idea is to feed into the local situation.
Yeah, we certainly haven't heard how we can support older people if they continue with the decision that was made at Westminster. We've got quite a lot of feedback about people who have quite rightly said that it's wrong. However, that seems, according to the Prime Minister yesterday and Deputy Prime Minister, they're not changing their minds. Devolved matters coming into Northern Ireland. We wanted local decision making, and we're looking to our leaders to sit round the table and make that decision and tell us how they can support older people with a winter coming in, which we know from previous winters. I mean, I've been on your programme practically every winter as we talk about the winter pressures and the impact that it's having on our hospitals. So we need to do it, and we need to do it urgently, and we need that anti-poverty strategy to get in place so that we do support all people who are on low income.
Brian Kingston, it's the 29th of August. These payments, if people are going to continue to get them, would start in November. Do you agree with Linda that the decision needs to be made urgently, either way?
Well, the sooner the decision is made, the better. That's obvious. It will have to be an informed decision, and it will have to be involved the full executive. But there is no easy outcome to this. There's no easy solution to it. If Westminster is not going to restore the funding for this or come up with mitigations, it means cutting public funding for other services in Northern Ireland, including those which are delivered for the benefit of our older citizens, particularly in health service. And so there is no easy outcome to this.
Is that a euphemism, Brian? And all I'm seeking here is clarity. Is the inference from you that if Westminster does not give Northern Ireland more money, it is more than likely that Northern Ireland will follow England, Scotland and Wales, and the winter fuel payments will be cut for those pensioners who are not on pension credit? Is that where we're at?
Yeah. Well, look, don't imagine that I somehow know the answer to your question. You know, the discussion has to happen around the executive table. I'm not party to what the outcome of that will be or what the current thinking. All I'm highlighting is the reality that this is funding which has been lost to Northern Ireland, effectively withdrawn from Westminster. And the only option for replacing that funding is to make other cuts to public services in order for the full universal nature to be maintained in November. That will be a very difficult outcome to see, considering what every executive minister is saying about the shortfalls they already have in funding for public services. But we do still make the appeal to Westminster, where the decision has been made by this Labour government. It wasn't in their manifesto, and then they decided to cut this. They said when they looked at the finances, the full picture. But it is a decision that was made by them alone, and the impact has been felt by millions of pensioners throughout the United Kingdom.
Okay. Brian, thank you very much indeed. We really appreciate it. You haven't talked this morning. Your party hasn't talked it. You're coming on both Good Morning Ulster and Nolan today to talk us through it, and we appreciate that. Thank you very much, Brian. Good morning to you. That's Brian Kingston from the DUP, 030 30 80 55 55. Linda Robinson, I know you have to go at 9:30 this morning. Another issue that we're looking at will be affecting more older people. The vast majority of people will be older people. And that is the story that we have today, that the Northern Trust, and this is a breaking story this morning from our programme, that the Northern Trust has signed off a 92-year-old woman being charged nearly double, an 86% rise in top-up fees for her care home position. Does this concern you?
Yes, it very much does. And I suppose what I should say, as I said earlier, in terms of our telephone lines and callers, health and social care issues are by far the biggest remit, I suppose, we have to cover. And top-up fees or third-party fees have been really a weekly call for us with families who, when they come into the care system, don't realise that the majority of residential nursing care is in the independent sector. There's a regional rate, which is around, I think for nursing, is around £853 per week. And the many homes will have to supplement that with a cost which is third-party. Our view has always been that that 2010 guidance is well out of date, and that we need a proper, fully costed, independent and statutory nursing and residential care system.
Can you help me with the basics of this from what you've just said? So if there's a charge for someone staying in a care home, there's an amount of money that the state will pay.
And then
the family or the person living in the home, whichever it is, needs to top it up to meet the charge if it's more than that, right?
If they're not a self-funder, that's correct, Stephen. But it's important to say that the third-party top-up fee cannot be paid by the resident or out of the resident's money. So what you have and what we certainly experience is a lot of older carers. And I mean, we've talked about a further stripping of money away out of income of older people, but we have a significant number of older people who perhaps pay for a husband or a wife who's in nursing or residential, and the third-party top-up must come from those individuals. It can't be paid out of the resident's personal income.
Well, we're about to hear about this story we've got from the actual person whose mum it is. Mother-in-law it is. She's coming on the radio in a few minutes' time. The son who is paying it is a 72-year-old pensioner. And he's the Northern Trust have signed off his top-up fee being increased from £100 per week to £186 per week. And the reason I'm resting this on the Northern Trust, it's my understanding that they've got to sign it off.
That's correct. And some of the challenges for that, and what is frightening for families, and that's what we hear when families come to us, is that the alternative to that is to perhaps relocate a resident, and you know, that's not good practice. If someone is well settled and comfortable in a home, and we have many, many families who are very willing and to pay but aren't able to pay those costs, but find that their resident, the person they've cared for, is well settled in a home, and that can be very disturbing and very frightening for all concerned. And it really backs to that statement that we've really got to get under the hood of what truly costs to care for people in Northern Ireland. And we're not doing that if we settle on 2010 guidance, which is probably what the Trust has looked at in terms of, you know, what are the costs and what are nursing homes incurring at the minute, probably in line with staffing costs, because I would probably say that's why that's been raised.
The reason this story, we reckon, is so important is we want to ask the question, if this care home is doing this and the Northern Trust has signed it off as okay to do it, is this likely to roll out? If it's based on costs, is this likely to roll out into other care homes in Northern Ireland? Will families see top-up fees dramatically increase?
I would be surprised if it isn't already happening, to be honest, because the cost for health and social care are not fully costed as they should be, and therefore these additional fees are to ensure that budgets are met, business cases are met, and so on and so forth. But that takes away from the personal impact on the residents, on family members, particularly, well, there's older family members, there's also younger family members having to pay, Stephen, and age, and I recognise that. You know, you may be a younger son or daughter with a family, school costs, and you will also have to pay this third party top up fee. Our view is that that needs to be urgently reviewed in line with what we believe is a proper cost for looking after all our people in Northern Ireland. So but I would say that this is not your only case. I think you'll find that we certainly have many cases of this. There is guidance. There is the opportunity where there are some cases where there is a criteria that the person wouldn't be paying it. For example, if there's no choice of care home given. So there's some very small reasons why the third party top up fee won't be put into place, and it's important the families do know that. They can certainly contact us. I can leave the number with your programme, because we do get these calls and we do need to go through the criteria to make sure that people are getting what is best for the person that is being placed, and also to reduce the stress and impact that is having, obviously, on those family carers.
I'm 51 now, right? So I'm starting to think about, well, what's life going to be like when you're 70 or whatever, and maybe you need a care home. I near fell off my seat yesterday when I looked at this story. This lady's care home costs £1,096 per week.
Yeah.
A grand a week.
Yeah, and that reflects a lot of the costs that have been brought in, really through the cost of living, through the energy costs for the home, the staffing costs for the home, and also probably just the running of a system that's probably got a number of other aspects in terms of whether it's providing a range of care for people with dementia, that obviously the staffing ratios need to increase. It's really getting back to we've really got to understand. We have this debate for domiciliary care as well. You know, what does it really cost to run a domiciliary programme? That's no different for residential and nursing. You know, we have to recognise that our cost for care is significantly increasing. The population that will be requiring that is significantly increasing as well, as we all live longer with a range of conditions.
Well, look, Linda, thank you very much indeed. I know you need to go. Thank you for coming on this morning. We'll hear this story straight after the news. Stay with us. The Stephen Nolan Show. We'll talk about Colm Eastwood standing down as leader of the SDLP later in the programme. Certainly I'm hearing that he wasn't pushed, that this was all planned, and someone senior within the SDLP telling me that it'll certainly be more seamless, the transition, than the Ulster Unionist Party transition. Senior person within the SDLP has said to me just this morning that they reckon they're pretty confident it will be Claire Hannah who will take over. And we were hearing some of this reporting from Jim McCormick this morning on Good Morning Ulster as well. So we've got that political story about Colm Eastwood. We've got our top story today about winter fuel payments, 0303 80 55 55. And now this third story this morning, which we're talking about on Nolan, top-up fees for care homes. There will be many families throughout Northern Ireland, their ears will be pricking up as they're hearing about a case where the top-up fee has gone from £100 to £186 per week, and the Northern Trust, where this happened, have said that's okay. They've signed it off. Now, Mary, it's not your real name, but this is your story, Mary. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Stephen.
And it's about your mother-in-law. So tell me what's happened.
Well, we got a bit of a shock whenever the bill came in. Normally, my husband, who's already retired, would pay the bill. But whenever he looked at it, he thought there must be a mistake. So he rang to query the amount, and they said no, there's no mistake. You know, it had risen from £100 per week to £186 per week. Now, an 86% rise in anybody's book is extortionate. It's just unbelievable. So we were quite shocked.
And you said maybe when the bill came in, were you not giving a heads up?
No. We got a letter to say that the room rate was rising, and that was in April. So that didn't tell us anything about the top-up fee. It didn't mention what our top-up fee would be, how much that would rise.
What? They didn't tell you how much it was going to be?
It told us what the room rate was going to be, that the increase in the room rate, but it didn't tell us what the top-up rise would be. Absolutely not. We didn't know that at all. So we did send a letter to the home to query it, and I suppose, and then we contacted the trust as well. Everybody's blaming everybody else. So the trust are saying, oh, it's the home. The home are saying it's the trust. And the bottom line, probably, Stephen, from what I've been hearing this morning, is that they're using a policy that's 14 years out of date, and the Stormont aren't really rising to this challenge of pensioners paying for pensioners, basically. That's what's happening. I mean, who can find £86 extra in a week in the current economic climate? That's the point. And I know from talking this morning and from listening to the show this morning that we are not on our own, that there's lots of other people out there. And actually, I'm glad I brought it to you, because you're the one person who's going to get that out there, and that possibly politicians need to rise to this challenge.
Well, again, you would be expecting political parties to be banging our door in to talk about this. Those political parties who purport to represent the working class, not just the super rich, for whom this doesn't matter. 86 quid a week doesn't matter. They spend that at dinner. But it's the fact that you weren't even given a heads up.
No, that we did get a letter, and we had to sign to say that we had received the increase in the cost. So whenever we go to the trust, they said, oh, well, you know, you were informed by the home about the rise, but we weren't told what our top-up fee was going to rise to. Now, can I just say as well, the home that my mother-in-law is in is a lovely home. She's very, very, very well settled. She's been there for 7 years. The staff are wonderful, and she's very, very well cared for. That is not an issue at all. And certainly a small rise, I can understand all of that. Fuel costs, staffing costs, the cost of living everywhere, all those things I can understand. However, an 86% rise is just unbelievable. I just still can't get my head around it. When it's per week. £86 per week, it's not per month or anything like that. And certainly most people would be able to budget for a small rise, but 86% is just a little bit. It's just a lot, you know. And I just thought you would be interested in that.
Oh, I'm interested big time. And again, it points back, you know, Stormont doesn't escape accountability here either. They wanted into local government. Could local government introduce legislation to protect people from this, to give mm-hmm. people a heads up, to create legislation that homes just cannot impose this?
Again, mm-hmm. Is it regulated in any way, Stephen? Should it be capped? There's lots of questions there. You know, who regulates an increase of that size? And also, can that not be capped at some point? You know, I mean, I just think there's lots of issues questions that you'd be asking. And we've already been in touch with Sammy Wilson, by the way, or Sammy Wilson's office, and they've taken all the details. Sammy was on holiday. They haven't come back to us. Somebody in the trust through with my mother-in-law, they haven't come back to us either. So there's lots of people who are not coming back to the table here to talk about this. And I say, thanks, Stephen, for taking on the story.
Well, we'll not be letting this go. And at the end of the day, you know, Sammy's entitled to his holidays.
Oh, certainly, absolutely.
So to be fair to him, when did you contact his office?
Well, it would be about 2 weeks ago now.
All right. Well, let's see what he does when he... I don't know if he's back from holiday or not.
Yeah.
I'm confused as to what the Northern Trust have said to us, to be honest. So mm-hmm. they've said to us that should a care home wish to introduce or increase any third-party contribution, a proposal is shared with the Trust. The Trust will then test the validity of the proposal, but ultimately the Trust is not responsible for approving the increase.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have no idea what that means. Why are they testing the validity of a proposed increase if they don't approve it? Like,
yeah.
What does it mean?
It doesn't really mean anything other than the fact that possibly, you know, I don't know, are they more aware of what the breakdown of that costing is? I don't know, Stephen. I really can't answer.
We went
that.
Back. We asked further questions. We said, while the trust does not approve the fees, it is our expectation that once a resident is in place, any increase would be in line with the regional uplift rate increase applied to the independent sector care home tariff. Well, 86% of a rise is not in line with the regional uplift rate increase, is it?
No. Can I just say, Stephen, that in previous times, the top-up fee was started off at £75 per week 7 years ago. And then at one point it was 90, and then it went up to 93 about a year later, and then it was 95 for a while. Yeah. Then it sat at 100 last time, and then from 100 to 186. Now that's the bit I can't get my head round.
Here's an explanation from the Trust, because following on from what I've just read, they say, this is the Northern Trust, acknowledges the Home had determined that its cost pressures were greater than the current tariff uplift rate, and on that basis undertook an assessment of those cost pressures. The Trust was assured from its own assessment that the proposed increases to charges were valid. So the Northern Trust is standing over a care home, increasing a cost from 100 quid to 186 quid a week. They're saying it's valid.
It's just something that really needs to go further, Stephen. It needs to go higher. More people need to take responsibility. There's a lot of hand-wringing and a lot of passing it between each other, blaming each other. We need to find out who makes this decision. Can it be regulated? Can it be capped? All of those things need to be discussed, you know. And I mean, it's just backbreaking for a pensioner or pensioners. My husband and his sister share it, and they're both pensioners, both in their 70s. So they're now finding £86 extra a week to pay for that. And no problem with the home. The care home's lovely and very, very well settled, and she likes it. Fine, that's grand. But, I mean, 86% is just an extortionate rise.
Here's Marjorie in Ardoyne. Morning, Marjorie.
Morning.
Go ahead, Stephen. Marjorie.
Stephen, would I tell you something? I'm not too well at the moment, but I think it's terrible. Terrible the way the pensioners are being treated. So it is. We are the ones sitting with the no money, not nobody else, not you, not anyone else. So all I would like to say is no one cares about us. No one's.
Is that how you feel?
Very much so. I get a pension. But I buy my gas electric. I have machines for my breathing. I have machines that run for other medical things for me. And it costs me near £50 of electric every week. And I am just disgusted to listen to the executive can't do this and the executive can't do that. The executive can do it okay if they want.
Are you not getting any help?
No, Stephen. And nor do I ask anyone for help. Because there is no one to ask. Because no one cares about you, Stephen.
Well, we're trying, Marjorie, to ask questions on your behalf. We've been doing it for the last week on this the winter fuel payments story. And we're trying to squeeze answers over the local political parties here as to where they stand on that issue alone. And this new story this morning.
It's terrible. It's terrible. It really is terrible. And I listen to your show. I've been listening to you for years. And I've been listening to your show, and I'm nearly disgusted with the government. So we are. So that's all I would like to say, Stephen, and it's been nice speaking to you.
Thank you very much. I think Marjorie, you know, she said it so politely there. She was saying it with respect, but she doesn't think that Stormont's fighting for her. So in terms of the winter fuel payment, it comes back. What's their decision? What are their proposals? I've heard from the DUP this morning about that story, that they're asking the British government to reverse their decision. Like, it's incredibly unlikely that's going to happen. So is there any notion of a different idea from Stormont around this? And then this new story this morning that we're hearing from Mary, where her family have had their top-up costs for their care home nearly doubled. It's gone up 86%. Now, the care home, you don't want to name the care home, Mary, because your mother-in-law is still in it.
Yes.
And you've asked us not to do that. We would be happy to name them. You've asked us not to. The care home have told us the top-up fee is the difference between the rate provided by the trust to cover the cost of care in a nursing home and what it takes to provide the highest level of care. And they're pointing out that the average cost of a nursing home care in the UK currently ranges between £1,410 and £1,470, and their current charge for a room is a lot less, £1,096.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the other regions, Stephen, I think the England, Scotland and Wales, I think from some research I've done myself, that they are actually supplementing care homes a lot more than our Northern Ireland executive are.
Why are you frightened of naming this home?
Well, I don't want it to be detrimental to my mother-in-law. You know, I wouldn't want, because it is such a good home, and she is well looked after and well cared for. And I mean, I don't know whether it's the actual home who have decided, well, they're going to slap this on, whether it's partly the trust at fault. So I suppose, Stephen, my confusion maybe is, you know, where, not really to lay blame as such, but how do you apportion that out? So who's, you know, I just don't know. I'm confused about all of that.
I'm just learning about this story through this example. You know, when the Northern Trust are telling us that they ultimately are not responsible for signing this off, is there any regulation around these top-up fees? And if not, why not?
Exactly. That's the question. That's the question. And is there a cap that can be put on? But, I mean, you know, when you listen to the girl from HNI who was on earlier, from the Trust, but she said they're using legislation from, 14 years ago? Well, what does that say?
Northern Trust say that ultimately they are not responsible for approving the increase. So who does?
Yeah.
And they clearly haven't disagreed. So they've agreed with the increase, but they're telling us they're not responsible for approving it. What does this mean?
Yeah.
So in what way? So if Trust decided to triple or quadruple top-up fees, is there anybody can stop them? I'm totally confused.
Which means, I mean, next year, what's the hike going to be? It's just, you know, I think, Stephen, it's the massive hike that really is still, you know, I think just all of a sudden, you know, I say if it had been half of that, it wouldn't even have, you know, yeah, you'd be thinking, okay, I need to budget for that. But,
here's the logic. If the Northern Trust, and they are, there's no if about it, the Northern Trust have said that this 86% increase was valid after they did their own assessment. So if it's valid for one care home in Northern Ireland, how could you argue it's not valid for all care homes?
Yeah.
Like, why would costs be different than any care home? They're all paying the same electric charge. They've got, you know, the heating, etc. They're paying the same increase
costs.
Staffing costs.
Yeah.
So are we likely to see nearly double top-up charges for care homes doubling across Northern Ireland? We need to delve into this. It's such an important story.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you.
Sam's in Belfast. Morning, Sam.
Hello, Stephen.
Morning. This is concerning, isn't it?
It is very concerning. I'm just sitting here contemplating my own mortality because I'm not long retired. What's the future for me? You know, if I end up in a nursing home?
Well,
my point, Stephen, is if they're talking about this extra £86 per week on top of their top-up fee, what happens if they can't afford it? Are they going to put this wee lady out?
Well, what does happen? Do you understand, Mary?
As far as I know, there's you know, you can have some sort of means testing, which we probably wouldn't. We've worked, Stephen, all our days, and I've gone flexibly retired myself just recently. So if those things are means tested, then, you know, we probably wouldn't get it. Which means people who've worked don't always. I think they said something, the Trust mentioned something about a hardship. You can plead hardship or something like that. But I mean, if you've worked and you've got any sort of savings or, you know, if you've contributed, you know, you probably aren't going to get that.
It's not first thing.
Hardship. You know what I mean? Do you understand where I'm coming from with that?
Yeah. Sam?
It's not fair. It's not right and it's not fair. They can afford to send billions of pounds
their war in Ukraine thousands of miles away, but they can't afford to look after our own pensioners.
We've asked, by the way, we asked this nursing home that you don't want us to name, Mary, what happens to the resident if top-up fees cannot be paid? And they've replied, we'd advise resident representatives who can't afford the increase to speak with our trust representative. We've been advised that the trust is a mechanism for dealing with disputes with fees where affordability issues are raised. It is important to note that their contractual agreement is between the resident representative and the trust. So the care home here is saying, well, the contract is between your mother-in-law, 92 years of age, and the trust. But the trust are signing off the increase. Well,
I don't know how they can. I don't know how they can justify it. I don't know how they can. I mean, say a small increase, certainly everybody can understand that in the current climate. However, to slap on another £86 per week is, I mean, if something in your own life, Stephen, increased by £86 a week, you'd be thinking, my goodness, £86 a week?
86%?
Yes. Yes.
Look, we have a lot more delving in to do. We'll go to the Department of Health. We'll get clarity around this. We'll find out if other trusts are following suit. And we won't let this story go. So thank you, Mary. Thank you, Sam. Morning to you. What a really interesting story. Now, next, the BBC understands that Colm Eastwood, well, he is to resign. He'll be resigning as the leader of the SDLP. He'll remain as leader until a successor is chosen by the party. Earlier this month, Claire Hannah, the SDLP South Belfast MP, was asked by Mark Crullers on the Red Lines podcast whether she would ever want the party leadership.
It's not something.
It's okay to say yes.
No, it's actually the opposite. It's not something that massively. I love being South Belfast MP, but it is a big job. I love being a mum of three, and it's a big job as well. So I like doing. You know, I work a lot and to shape the things that I can. But I know it's a really tough job. And I hope that doesn't sound selfish. But you know, I also try to do the things that, you know, that I'm good at and that I add most value to, and that's where we are.
Well, Rory O'Kane, former Director of Communications, SDLP with us. Morning, Rory.
Morning, Stephen.
Morning. Former SDLP spad Brendan McGrew. Morning, Brendan.
Hi, Stephen.
I just don't know, genuinely don't know, that when Claire was answering that question, did she have any whiff that Eastwood was about to go?
Well, I think, Stephen, that interview was probably 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, something like that. And I don't think it's any major surprise within the higher echelons of the SDLP that he has chosen this moment to go. I think that the Westminster election in July this year was going to go one or two ways. They're either going, the party was going to hold both seats, which it obviously did. And Colin would think that's probably a decent enough time and package to hand over to an incumbent leader. Or else, you know, he may have lost his seat and there was pressure from Sinn Féin on Colin, but he held that off robustly. And had he lost, then he probably would have had to go. So I think in all circumstances, those who were keeping an eye on the party, and bearing in mind the fact that he'd been there for 9 long years, even though he's a young man, he's been there for 9 years, a long time to lead a party, pushing against the wind all of the time. I think that this Westminster election was probably going to be the end of his leadership.
But you've always got to ask the question, Rory, why now? Like, is leadership a lonely place for these people? Is it too much, the cut and thrust? My goodness, politics can be toxic here. There can be a lot of pressure on politicians. I'm just interested why someone as good a communicator as Colm, that guy knows how to communicate, and he's a young man. Why would he get out now?
I mean, it is a tough job, and certainly when you're fighting electoral battles that aren't going your way in terms of how the party's going, you do have the weight of the world on your shoulders and you have a lot of responsibility. I think perhaps what Colm sees now is sort of a bit of clear water to the next potential election, perhaps 3 years down the line, and thinks that it's time for someone else to do. I have to say, in my interactions with Colm over the past few months, I very much came away with the impression that should he hold his Westminster seat, he was going to seriously look at his leadership. And I think he wanted to be in a position where he could make a decision in his own time and of his choosing, rather than someone else coming to do it. But I think for the SDLP and for leadership, I mean, we can talk about personalities, but I mean, the party has to seriously ask itself, what's it for, rather than who is going to lead it. And I think that's the debate that the new leader will need to carry forward.
I think an interesting question also, Brendan, is, you know, whether it is Claire Hannah or Matthew O'Toole, will the party be any different? Will it be any different to the messaging, to the prospects of the SLP?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways to answer that one, Stephen. I think that we are in a new place because we do now finally have the executive up and running. But I think the way that the SLP would benefit from that is to have a long period of unbroken government. As long as our government is in suspension, restoration, suspension, restoration, as long as we're playing knockabout politics, then the bigger groupings will always fight elections based on make us the biggest, make us first minister, make us put the others in the deputy first minister. And as long as we fight elections on that basis, there's very narrow ground for the SDLP and indeed the UUP to find some space. So if we get to the stage where the electorate are making choices based on what's the actual quality of government that we're getting here, and that's the role then the SDLP has to carve out to say, you know, there's a different way of doing government. We've got a different set of priorities.
Is there, though?
Strategies. But there can be, Stephen, but we haven't yet seen, and to be fair to Sinn Féin and DUP, they haven't bedded down yet they haven't been able to measure them and assess some of the quality of government they delivered because it's always just stop-start politics.
Well, look, Claire Hannah, there may be a coronation. We're hearing that. She may be unchallenged. Matthew O'Toole, you know, again, is an articulate, Rory, experienced politician. He's been the leader of the opposition. Has he come forward with anything that feels new, that you would get a sense if this guy gets the top job, there's going to be a refreshment of the party?
I think opposition give you the space to start laying that out, but as Brendan says, probably just haven't had the time to see it yet. I think he's made a fair fist of opposition on the basis of what he's been able to see and do in terms of what the government present. But there's another side to that coin as well, that the SPLP will need to come forward, not just chip away at what others are doing, but show what they can offer. But also I think there's another question. I mean, that is certainly where votes will be got in middle ground, but also there's the SPLP's position within nationalism and how they take on the juggernaut of Sinn Féin in an all-Ireland dimension. And Colin has tried to shift the party into this new Ireland space, and so the new leader has to almost ride two horses. Like, what can we do domestically within the north and also within the island?
Brendan, finally, Colm Eastwood isn't walking away from politics. He's staying in it. How difficult will it be to remain in a party and you were once top dog and now you're not? Like, from a human level, what's that feel like, I wonder?
Well, yeah, I think I think that'll be fine, Stephen. Colm is very, very dedicated to Derry, to do what he can to deliver for Derry. And he's spent the next 5 years, he's only just elected, he's got 5 years now, as an MP, and he'll work hard to deliver for Derry, and I think he will remain politically visible and active. It's a change of role for him, but it'll amount to a slowing down in all likelihood for him, but I think he will remain very active, and he's not disappearing from the political scene locally, not by any means.
Brendan, Rory, thank you very much indeed. I see lots more of you still calling us about this nursing home story. We promise you we're on it. 030 30 80 55 55 is the number into the BBC. The Nolan Show on Thursday, the 29th of August. Here comes the news at 10. This lot are shouting me behind the scenes this morning. They clearly don't realise just how ill I am. My ribs are still sore, and nobody has given me sympathy. If you haven't been tuning in to hear about this, so I decided, and I know it certainly was the first time. I know you're not even going to believe this, but I got one of these steamers. You know the wee steamer where you wash your tiles? And there's a lady that's been with me years, Marlene. She comes down every Wednesday and she tidies the whole house and does all that for me. Does my washing. Washes everything. What a job she has. And I decided last week, no, I'm going to help Marlene. So I got the steamer out. I had no idea how to work it, but anyway, put the water in it. I then threw soap or something on the floor. Apparently you're not supposed to do that, but I didn't know. And I started washing the tiles. It was actually quite therapeutic, and I thought, I could get into this. I like this. Put on a wee bit of music. There's me washing the tiles. Until I slipped and went up in the air. Now, I didn't fall down. 19 stone of me went up in the air because I didn't know not to walk on the wet tiles. Up in the air, right down in my back. And there was such a thud that I thought to myself, I'm in trouble here. What have I broken? So I lay there for about 2 or 3 minutes. And I was afraid to move. I was in that much shock. So then I moved. I felt a wee bit bruised, but that was all right. Up and about it, wee bit bruised. The next day, front of my rib cage starts getting sore. Really sore. The next day after that. To the point where last Saturday night, I was finding it difficult to breathe in deep. Because when I did, it was really excruciatingly sore. And every time I coughed, it was the same. So I tried not to cough and all this mucus building up in my chest. And somebody said to me, that's why you have to go to the doctor to get these things checked out. Because that's how you get pneumonia. If you're not coughing naturally, you're not breathing naturally. So I'm just wondering from those of you, I know you were calling me about this last week, if this has happened to some of you. And maybe you can come on, pick up the phone, because this lot behind the scenes, as usual, they don't believe me. They take their sickies. Brendan has the sweats every other week. We get a phone call from him at night time. He gets the sweats, so he's not in for days afterwards. But I have soldiered on. I've come into the BBC. But maybe some of you can pick up the phone. 03030 80 55 55. And in my pain, in my discomfort, what have they also done? They've given me Mike Parry this morning as a guest. Like, could they make this show any worse for me today when I'm not well? The commentator, Mike Parry, Belfast Telegraph night editor, John Laverty, with us this morning. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning, John.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Now, this story about Michael O'Leary, he is the boss of Ryanair. He's calling for a 2-drink limit for passengers to sort out disorder on flights. He said, we don't allow people to drink drive, yet we keep putting them up in an aircraft at 33,000 feet. So, Mike, should the restriction happen?
Well, you sound to me like you need a strong drink at the moment, Stephen,
yes,
to cope with that back of yours, okay? I hope you've spoken to your fellow Ulsterman, Eamon Holmes, who I work with a lot, because he's got a back problem, so he might be able to help you.
But this isn't a back problem, this is my ribs.
Well, you know, it started at the back, didn't it? It works up, so I get it seen up. But first of all, I'd have a stiff drink. Now, on the drinking in airports, right, that quote you just put out about 33,000 feet, I think that comes from Mr. Tim Martin. Now, Tim Martin owns Wetherspoons, one of the biggest pub chains United Kingdom. He's a very responsible man. I know him well. And his pubs at Stansted Airport and Gatwick Airport are two of the biggest pubs in this country. They're huge. And I've been at both of them actually, but most recently I've been at the one at Gatwick at 4 o'clock in the morning. And I've seen people starting to get the ale down with their breakfast, with the bacon and the sausage. Only 1/3 of the profits from those airport pubs, which are hugely busy, comes from booze. The rest of it comes from food. People eating their breakfast, mid-morning, lunch, before they go on holiday. Now, they are very responsible drinkers, because I've been flying for 40 years and I've never had a problem with a drunk on a plane, and I've never been in an airport where I've seen a drink problem, because people are simply happy and they want to have a few drinks. They're probably going off on holiday and they think, let's start it with a gargle. And we started with a gargle, and what I do think should happen is that the staff for the airlines should be trained to spot the troublesome passenger who's had a few too many in the bar, or more likely these days, Stephen, it could have something to do with drugs. That could be powder or tablets or something like that. There should be a spotter to get them, because you can't ruin the joy of arriving at an airport, into the bar, having a few drinks before you go on holiday. Don't ruin it for everybody. Clamp down on the individual.
But what is it about,
give it a bad name.
What is it about you people that you need to drink loads before doing things? Like, why not a couple of drinks? That's what you would be allowed under this policy.
Yeah.
And get on the plane and go on holiday. Why do people need to drink to the point they get stoshes? I don't understand. I did it when I was 18. I haven't done it the last 30. I don't understand people that want to get bloated.
No, you see, I don't think you understand, Stephen. I run a campaign called Blado in Modo, okay?
What?
That Blado in Modo. It's bladderation in moderation, okay? That's the way I live my life. Now, the point is, what you're saying is, oh, go into the bar, have 2 pints, and then go to the departure gate. Supposing your plane's delayed 4 hours. Are you telling me then that people have to live like monks and sit at their table in the pub and not drink for 4 hours?
Well, maybe go shopping, maybe have a meal, maybe do something. But why does everything need to be associated with going on holiday around drink? I don't understand it.
It doesn't have to be, but at the same time, you are enjoying a period of leisure in your very busy year, which probably only comes around once a year. So you can lay your hair down a bit, you can change your social habits, you can change your living style and let go for a couple of weeks and start that with a few drinks in the bar at the airport. And as I say, I think they're incredibly well run. The staff there keep an eye on everything. And I think only a real Grinch, you know, a real doomer, would want to put the lid on that happy occasion prior to going on holiday.
John?
Morning, Stephen. Well, the thing about it is, people are... there's nothing wrong with having a couple of drinks before going on a flight, but it's... what astonishes me is how early it starts. I mean, Belfast City Airport's bar, it opens at 5 a.m. And one of the two at Belfast International Airport opens at 3:30 a.m. Now, I don't mind a pint. I don't mind a glass of wine before a flight. But every time I go to these airports, I see people drinking at that time of the morning. I think that's a real problem thing. I really do. It's bizarre that people, I think, you know, need to drink that early in the morning, before a flight. And another thing is that Michael O'Leary, he's talking about airports. He's not talking about his own planes serving the alcohol. He's talking about the airports, which he isn't technically involved in.
I didn't notice that. You're right.
Oh, yeah. John's made a very good point there. Sorry, John, to interrupt. But the thing is that Mr. O'Leary is saying, oh, you shouldn't be drinking in those bars and getting on my planes, and then encouraging people to buy a can of beer at £10 a shot, for which he gets the profits, not Weatherspoons, when they're up in the air, and they are a captive audience because they can't get it anywhere else.
Well, he can. His argument would be he can control the consumption of alcohol on his flights.
They don't on flights. Normally speaking, they don't. Normally speaking, they go up and down the aisle. Any more booze and all that, I don't see any control on aeroplanes.
Stephen, it's a really difficult thing to police as well. I mean, with regard to what, you know, O'Leary's saying, I mean, how do you know someone has 2 drinks or 4 drinks or 5 drinks? Some people are very tipsy after 2 drinks, and some people aren't tipsy at all after 10 drinks. It's a really difficult thing to police, and I don't think it's ever going to work. I mentioned earlier on about the Belfast airport bars. They're not under the same restrictions as the rest of the bars in Northern Ireland, so that's why they're opening up all hours of the morning. But I mean, it's all about people being absolutely sensible about this. If you're boozing at 3:30 in the morning, there is something seriously wrong. And I think that actually, Michael Leary talks about a plane at 33,000 feet in the air is not a good place to be drunk. Well, yeah, see, there's a hospital. Hospitals don't allow people to be drinking. Maybe people should go a lot further and just say no drink on planes.
That's absolute nonsense, John. You sound like the Bishop of Ulster now, you know, spreading the good word to his flock. And can I say just 2 things? Firstly, it's never the same people drinking at 3:30 a.m. at the Belfast airport, because they only go on a holiday probably once a year. So it's not like half of Belfast is heading to the airport at 3:30 a.m. to get a drink. It's very occasional. And the other thing is, by the way, last time I was in Belfast, the Weatherspoons pubs, because those are what we're talking about at Stansted and Gatwick, don't open until 11 o'clock in Belfast, whereas on the mainland in the United Kingdom, they open at 9 o'clock. So I would say Belfast people are more responsible drinkers than most.
Listen, I want to ask you two before you go about a completely different subject.
We don't have to take a long to have a good time. Oh, no.
guess what? I'm asking you, Mike Parry, and you, John Laverty, about skinny dipping, because the Royal National Lifeboat Institution are celebrating their 200th anniversary. They are asking people if they want to go skinny dipping in the North Coast this weekend. It's being hosted by the British Naturism Northern Ireland, marking their 60th anniversary. What do you think? Is it a bit weird to be going skinny dipping, or would you recommend it this weekend, Mike?
Well, I certainly wouldn't do it, because if I did, I'd get harpooned by a whaling ship, that's for sure. So I wouldn't do it for that reason. But secondly, only an exhibitionist would go skinny dipping. What makes anybody think that the rest of the human race wants to see the naked form of oneself? It's disgusting. To my mind, it's slightly perverted. I'd recommend everybody not to do it.
It's not perverted unless you make it perverted, is it? It's the natural human body. It's being done for charity. What's wrong with...
Well, we don't walk around in the street without any clothes on, Stephen. Maybe you do, but I certainly don't. So I don't see it as a natural form of living.
Would you be embarrassed, or do you think it's somehow dirty?
Well, I wouldn't be embarrassed. I would just feel like a complete idiot exhibitionist, and I wouldn't subject my body, beautiful, to the eyeballs of other human beings.
John Laverty?
Well, Stephen, in order for me to do it, I would need to be drinking at one of the Belfast airports from 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah,
to give me the courage to do such a thing, but each to their own. If that's what they want to do, that's fine. Some people feel very comfortable doing it. I wouldn't, and I think that if it's for a good cause, well, whoever wants to do it, let them do it.
Well, here's the press release from the RNLI. Have you ever fantasised about a dip in the sea without trunks or swimming togs? Now's your chance with a skinny dip en masse planned on the North Coast this weekend. They're going to section off part of the beach. Where's this? Down in Port Stewart.
That's even worse. That's encouraging a load of people to get naked together.
Yes.
That, to me, is a recipe for disaster.
Port Stewart.
It's also going to be a disaster for people like me who work in newspapers and will have to pixelate out a lot of things, shall we say, if there's pictures taken of these things.
It's true.
I wonder if Barrett Best or Mark Crothers going to go. I have no idea. Mike, thank you. John Laverty, thank you. Mark Simpson's a keen swimmer. He might be down there in the nip. Michael in South Belfast. Good morning, Michael.
North Belfast, Mr. Nolan.
Hold on a minute.
Yeah?
There are games being organised. Naked games being organised as well.
Oh, really?
In Port Stewart Strand. Dippers are asked to come along to the far end of the Strand.
Yes.
At 11 o'clock on the day.
11 to 3, yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I'm a bit like the boy out of Kajagoogoo. I'm too shy. Also, I can't go anywhere without my dog, and he might get a wee bit puzzled. Maybe he might think there's a lot of sausages in view, so it might be treacherous. I suggest you go, because with your injury, it's a be a sunny day, thank God, on the salt water. It might help your ribs, and also it might draw lots of crowds and support this very worthwhile cause.
Well, it is a worthwhile cause, but do you agree with Mike Parry that it's a little bit strange?
It is. I do agree to some degree, but it's a section of the beach which will be cordoned off, and other people who might be offended, they don't have to participate or view it, but it is a very good cause. Reading the blurb here, they raised thousands last year for the British Heart Foundation, so I think it's a very altruistic, event.
The Nolan Show can confirm that we will be contacting Councillor Jim Rogers, because Jim's a keen swimmer, to ask if he is possibly gone down. Who knows? We'll give Jim a ring now.
Yeah.
Given the fact he never stops telling us he's up at Templemore Baths, and see if he's gone down to Port Stewart. I think we could ask the question this morning: who would you like to go skinny dipping with?
Yeah. I contacted a lady friend I was about, just Carrie McLean, and she lives up there.
Does she?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you should contact Carrie.
Are you going, Michael?
No, I'm too shy. No, and also, my dog, I can't go anywhere without him. And it might be hazardous.
No, we heard that.
Yeah, I'm telling the truth.
Yes.
would be very very upset if I didn't bring him.
I think it's interesting to see who will
appear. I think you should go.
Hold on a minute. Councillor Rogers, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you today?
Well, I know that you and I had a traumatic event together. It's locked in my brain. I think it was about 7-8 years ago, where I went up to Templemore Baths, if you remember this, Jim, and I thought I was going up for a meeting, and there you were, standing there in your trunks. And I haven't recovered since. You had your wee hat on and your trunks on, and seriously, I've been in some type of therapy ever since. Now, the country needs to know, are you going skinny dipping in Port Stewart at the weekend on behalf of the RNLI?
That's a possibility. I'm trying to work around going to a football match or heading up to the North Antrim coast.
Really? And you've no inhibitions, Councillor Rogers?
None whatsoever.
Why not?
Well, I just don't have, and if I did, I wouldn't be telling you because you would be telling everybody else.
It's for a good cause, Jim. So,
oh, I know it is. It's for a very good cause, and that's so important.
Yes.
You do a great job.
What do you
fantastic
think?
Fantastic people.
It would take a certain confidence, would it not, to do this at the weekend?
Of course it would. I myself am a very confident person. I know you are too. So it's important that you're involved and not just rely on me and others.
Yes. So there's a possibility, Councillor Rogers, the people of Northern Ireland could see you up there in Port Stewart. This might have an impact on crowds, either negative or positive, at the weekend.
It could well be, but I have to prepare myself for that. And I'm sure after I end this phone call, I'll be getting lots of phone messages from people wanting to know what time the event's going to happen. And
11
so forth.
O'clock.
I'll play my cards very close to my chest.
Thank you very much, Jim. Good sport. Thank you for coming on. Mrs. Robinson, tell me you're not going skinny dipping at the weekend.
Good morning, Mr. Newland.
Tell me you're not going.
I'm not. I'll stick with the same context as your previous caller. I'll keep my cards close to my heart.
What are you calling the biggest show in the country about this morning, Mrs. Robinson?
Well, as a member of the BN.org.uk, the British Naturism.
You're a member of it?
I am indeed, yes.
Really?
Yes.
Well, one of our callers a few moments ago suggested it's weird.
Not at all. What's weird about it? The human body.
How long have you been doing this?
Quite a while. We have lots of activities throughout the year. We also have a naked yoga session.
Oh dear.
You would find it most beneficial at the moment with your bad back.
Bad ribs.
Oh, sorry. I do apologise. Ribs, back, legs. Yoga is wonderful for the body.
You see,
wonderful for the mind.
With my bad ribs, I couldn't be doing the burpees or anything at this event. I couldn't do it.
Well, we would let you have some light exercises to get you into the breathing and to hopefully to ease some of your pain.
So you're a member of the British Naturist Association?
Yes.
How long have you been a member for?
Quite a while.
Many years?
Probably about 7.
And where do you do this in Northern Ireland?
There's lots of places.
Like where?
Well, you can go to Bloody Bridge.
Where?
Bloody Bridge in Newcastle.
So if I was going for a walk in Newcastle with a poke, I'd see you there, Starkers.
Possibly.
Do you not have to give notice to the people?
Well, all the areas are cordoned off that people are able to, you know, we're able to roam freely.
Oh dear.
What do you mean, oh dear? It's just your body. Do you not walk around the house naked?
I do.
So do I.
I do.
And do you enjoy that?
Absolutely. When I get in from work, and if I'm tired, there's nothing that makes me more comfortable I'm watching TJ Hooker at the minute, and there's nothing makes me more comfortable than taking my clothes off, getting into the house, you get your clothes off, lie on the sofa, packing a prawn cocktail, wee tin of juice, watching TJ Hooker. But that's
in the privacy
of my own home.
Well, you can do it in your own home.
But why would you want to do this outside in front of other people?
Well, it's with other like-minded people. You know, the other side of the equation is I can walk, or I can't walk through my hometown with my T-shirt off. And yet you go into Belfast or Lisburn or during the hot weather, and all I see are these men with their tops off or their T-shirt wrapped around their waist and their belly and their man boobs on full show. So what's the difference between a man doing that and me doing that?
But what I'm interested in, look, we're having a laugh this morning, but the serious end of this is...
Look at the money that's going to be raised this weekend.
Yeah, but
look, you go to the beach this weekend, do you see how many people are there?
But the serious end of this is, what is the enjoyment of doing it with other people? So I understand why in the privacy of your own home, there's something, look, you know, I don't wear clothes in bed. People don't wear clothes in bed, all that kind of stuff. But that's the privacy of your own home. But why would you want to do it in front of groups of other people? Why?
Because those people are like-minded like myself. They enjoy the freedom of not wearing clothes. Then we enjoyed nature.
But that's not about freedom, is it? Because you've got that, you can have the freedom without doing it in front of other people. Why do it with other people?
Because we just enjoy each other's company. We are in our own bodies. You know, you're making a lot more out of it than what, you know, you're trying to find the dirty part of
I'm
it.
Not.
And it's not like that. Well, I think you are, Mr. Nolan.
I am not.
You know, you're trying to say, oh, well, you know, these people are all naked. Like, what's the kinky part of this? You know, we're in our own bodies. We're in our own freedom. We enjoy.
Will the majority of people, either at this event at the weekend or the majority of naturists, are they the old wrinkly people? Are there many young people do this, or is it all people, you know?
People of all ages.
Really?
You know, 9 times out of 10, you know, a mixed group. You send one of the same Vinny out this weekend, and let him, you know, come back with the statistics of ages. No, they're not old, wrinkly old men or old, wrinkly women. I'm not old, I'm not wrinkly.
Right.
You know, that, something else, you know, whilst you were talking there about getting home at night and taking your clothes off, you ask any woman, what's the first thing she does when she gets through the door after being stuck, held up in a bra all day.
Yeah, as soon as I get through the door, I take my bra off too.
Well, there you go. Women, you fling it out, you pull it out the arm, you want to throw it up in the air and just let them boobs be free. And we enjoy that. So come along. Come along to our naked yoga class.
Listen, the sixth floor management team will be having a heart attack. Let the boobs be free on the BBC. That's another complaint.
I know. I'll not be allowed back on.
Oh, you'll be welcome back on.
You have a good day.
Thank you, Mrs. Robinson. Maybe see you on the bridge. Norman and Bangor. Good morning, Norman.
Good morning, Stephen. I have a new name for you.
What's
Michael
that?
Crawford. Some mothers do have them. You've hurt your toe.
Yes.
Now you've hurt your ribs. Have you not got anyone comes in and does all this work for you?
I do, but I decided to do the cleaning to help the cleaner.
And look what happened to you.
I know.
And look at the toe you give yourself.
Oh, I know.
You dropped something on it. So you did. And that is for that skinny dipping. Well, everything hangs out there, doesn't it? With some shapes and sizes.
Thank you, Norman. If you want to contact AJNI, by the way, there is a helpline for our other stories this morning, 0808 80 87 57 5. Thanks for your company today. We'll see you all tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show!